Welcome to Trust in Tech. I'm Alice Hensberger. I'm here today with Colleen Murn, Head of Trust and Safety at Clubhouse.
Hi, Colleen. Thanks for joining us. It's really nice to have you here today.
Hi, Alice. Thanks so much. I'm excited.
So today we're going to talk about small companies and small teams in trust and safety. And I know that you have been at some really large companies, and right now you are at Clubhouse, which is very small. So you have some good perspective, especially for folks who perhaps have been affected by layoffs and are considering what their next career move is going to be. I thought talking to you a little bit about what it's like being in a small company, what the pros of small companies are, or what to consider might be timely. I too am at a small company. I've only ever worked at small companies. So I'm actually really curious to learn from you more about big companies and what the differences are. So with that, can you give us a little bit of background about where you've worked, where you are today, and how your career has progressed?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to. So I started my career at the FBI, which is a huge, huge organization, obviously, and then transitioned into tech via Google, and more specifically got into trust and safety at YouTube. And so then from YouTube, I had the opportunity to go to Clubhouse and lead trust and safety at Clubhouse. And as you mentioned, so it's kind of going from a big company where you're kind of in charge of this one sliver of it to going to a smaller place where you get to look at a broader scope of things. So I moved from covering kind of two big policy areas to covering everything from violent extremism to child safety and a bunch of areas that I, to be honest, didn't have exact subject matter expertise in, but really wanted to gain that. So it's been a phenomenal transition in terms of like learning experiences and growth for me to go to a smaller company to get to have that kind of breadth of experience.
With your team, you said you specifically have learned a lot about policy and a whole variety of policies. I know on my team, that's something that comes up a lot as well. I think tech policy positions within trust and safety teams are one of these things that everybody seems to want to do these days. Yeah. Most of the messages that I get from people on LinkedIn about how do I break into trust and safety? How do I find a job? People are really, really interested in tech policy in particular. And it's actually one of my favorite parts of my job too. I love policy. Totally. And with my team, we don't have any in-house full-time policy people. We don't have any policy consultants either. We just have no policy team. It's myself doing the majority of it. I've been doing policy for dating apps for a very long time because I worked at a dating app, OkCupid, before Grindr. So I wrote their community guidelines and then redid it at Grindr, and I'm redoing it again for another time.
Oh yeah, I'm excited about that project.
And I'm bringing my team in along for the ride because I think pretty much everybody on the trust and safety team working with me would love to get into policy potentially at a larger company someday. And so one of the big advantages of not having any policy person on the team is that then everybody's doing policy because you really need help here and there. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, it has been. And I think in both situations, even at a big company versus a small company, I think it can be hard to distinguish the different roles. There's like policy development folks at a bigger company versus, you know, YouTube, we used to call them enforcement managers. But of course, there's a lot of kind of overlap, right? The people who are doing the enforcement and operations are getting kind of the on the ground insights that are able to help collaborate with policy to write really good and scalable policies. So at Clubhouse, we do have a policy cross-functional person to help us think through those things. But everyone on my team kind of manages their own policy area. And so gets to be sort of the subject matter expert on that and is working in close collaboration with policy development on, you know, what changes need to be made to the community guidelines, what's not scaling well with our vendor team, where do we need to add clarifications and things like that. And so I think that's been really fun because I think it's it moves really, really fast, right? Like within a day, we can kind of make an update versus like at a larger company, you're going to have to work a lot more with, you know, different cross-functional folks and executive leadership and things like that to potentially get something across the finish line. So I've been enjoying kind of the nimble pace at a smaller company for that piece.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody who worked at Google a couple of weeks ago, and he said that it was so frustrating because he would have an idea of something that he was sure was going to help the community and make things better. But there was so much bureaucracy and red tape to get through that it would be, you know, really, really difficult to push an idea through. And it makes sense. I understand why big companies do that because the scale is so different. So when you're talking about Google scale, even something that is a fraction of a percentage of inaccuracy is going to affect thousands or millions of people. Whereas with much smaller platforms, your false positives are going to have an effect, but it's one that is able to come through the customer support team and be fixed on an individual basis.
It comes to light much more quickly, right? Versus like you're training, you know, thousands of vendors and it's hard to figure out if there's a gap once it's launched. So no, I totally agree. Both systems kind of operate as they should for a reason in that way.
Another thing that you and I talked about as we were preparing for this episode was the really nice part about working for a small company is that you get to collaborate cross-functionally a lot more. And both of us actually were talking a little bit about product, especially. So what has it been like for you working with the product team?
Yeah, I think this part's been so fun and interesting for me and something I probably didn't expect coming into it, but just getting to be on board for some of the decision-making before a product or feature goes live and getting the chance to weigh in on what the trust and safety implications will be ahead of time has been really, really fun. So for example, you know, when deciding to, okay, we're going to launch to under 18 users, like how do we do that safely? What features do we need to put in place? What, you know, from a compliance perspective, from a, what's the right thing to do by underage users? How do we kind of establish everything and working with the product team? I've had a really, really phenomenal experience working with folks. And I think the size of the company helps in terms of being able to work really closely with people before a launch. But we also have, you know, just some wonderful product managers who are eager to get kind of those trust and safety and, you know, legal operations inputs before something goes live so that you don't have to kind of take anything back or build anything retroactively. So I think that process has come a long way and I've been really, really happy with it. Just makes it a lot easier when you can kind of say your piece ahead of time and work together on, like, you know, you don't want to be a blocker. That's the worst part about this job. I don't know if you've experienced this, Alice, but a lot of times in trust and safety are kind of the do you even know how people are going to abuse this? And your mind immediately goes to the worst of the worst. And but luckily I feel like we've found a good way to, you know, kind of bring those insights from, you know, the worst of the worst and where some people will go and kind of come up with a good risk mitigation strategy.
Yeah, that's been my experience as well. I oversee trust and safety, but I also oversee customer experience as a whole, which is also customer support and our user insights. So it's kind of a nice excuse for me to chat with the product people in a way that's helpful and helping them understand what our users want, what will help them grow, what will help the user base be, you know, happier and more fulfilled and long-term stick around more. And also, by the way, here's the trust and safety implications of something that you might be doing. And so then I don't always have to be the no person.
That's a good way to do it.
So what does your team look like right now? I know you wanted to brag about how great they are. I also want to brag about how great my team is. So let's talk about building teams in small companies and what they look like and what we look for as hiring managers.
Awesome. So I lead our trust and safety team, which also includes our legal operations team. And so I have an awesome head of legal ops who also manages our child safety. So I feel like you know, she and her team cover kind of like the most complex issues out there between legal compliance requirements and figuring out child safety. And then my team also supports all the policy enforcement. So everything from, you know, violent extremism to unauthorized sales to misinformation, you know, every policy area. And I think that's something that's been kind of fun, but also hard to figure out, is getting the right folks on the team who are able to become subject matter experts in a policy area, but then also kind of needing to have what we kind of call it like vertical and horizontal coverage as well. So, you know, the person on my team who's leading hate and harassment is also managing all of our vendor operations and leading, you know, all the trainings and making sure the quality looks good. So everyone's kind of wearing a bunch of different hats between, you know, being a subject matter expertise and then also doing a lot of like the functional oversight of the team to make sure that the ops are in a really good place. So, which is like, it's both really hard. I feel like the team does such a good job of managing both. It's like kind of requires two different key skill sets, but it also presents a ton of opportunities. You know, some folks can raise their hand after they've, you know, been managing a policy for a while and be like, oh, like need a refresh, need something new. And there's always no shortage of new opportunities to take on, which is great.
Yeah. In a small company, I think there's a lot of room for you to kind of raise your hand and say, I know this isn't my job, but I'm really interested in it. And I'm really, you know, willing to put in some extra work. And more likely than not, your manager will be like, oh, great, we do. We need somebody paying attention to that, please, no, by all no means.
No one is turning away. Yeah. People raising their hand to help out with work. No, I agree. I think that's been one of the fun things about being a small company too, even from my perspective. You know, at U2, my world was kind of trust and safety and felt like I had a good handle on that organization. But being in a smaller company, it's been fun to see like, okay, how does that make sense with comms and, you know, and product and, you know, what are the trust and safety implications on finance and really thinking about, you know, kind of from a core business perspective where everything fits in is really cool for myself and, you know, my team members to get access to anywhere they want to take their careers is pretty easy to facilitate, which is nice.
Yeah. What types of people do you look to hire with people who can wear this many hats?
Oh my gosh. Yes, people who love firefighting and love the chaos a little bit. No, I think in both trust and safety and being at a startup, I think, you know, kind of some of the core qualities that I'm looking for are like scrappiness and people who are able to be nimble and flexible. It'll depend a little bit on like a particular role that we might be hiring for. So for example, we were looking for a child safety specialist this year, and we really were looking for, you know, someone with deep subject matter expertise in that space. But oftentimes within trust and safety, there are roles where you might not have expertise. Like actually when I went into YouTube, I wouldn't call myself a harmful, dangerous expert on guns and drugs and challenges and pranks. I don't know that many people have that. So I think there are a lot of cool roles in trust and safety that don't require, you know, in-depth subject matter knowledge and are more looking for kind of generalists to kind of jump in who are excited to learn and eager to try their hand at a lot of different things. So I think the biggest things I look for are like, great communicators, people who work very easily cross-functionally and are always kind of like hungry to learn and try new things. And I guess like kind of like low ego. Like I think it's a lot of like failing and you know, trying new things in this kind of nascent field. So I think folks are okay with, you know, testing out different things and seeing what works ends up being a great quality for a trust and safety professional, in my view. What about you? What's your experience been like?
People who are flexible and curious, which yeah. I think is very similar to what you just said, especially in a really small company, you can't guarantee that people are going to be able to move up to management in the next 3 to 5 years if they stick with your company, because when you only have a small team, then there's a small number of management roles for people to go into if your manager even leaves to begin with, which yeah. hopefully they don't because they love you and they love working with you. but it's very, you know, it's then very tricky to find the right combination of people who are really smart, ambitious, want to work hard, want to contribute at a high level, want to grow their careers. I want to hire, you need people like that at small companies. You can't really have people who are just going to kind of sit in around and like do the bare minimum and then leave, because every single individual person on your team has a much bigger role in the company overall. And so you need people who are going to work hard and keep growing, but then people who are flexible enough and, you know, easygoing enough to not care too much about what exactly that looks like, as long as you say, I'm going to invest in your career development. I'm going to make sure you're working on projects you care about. I'm going to make sure you keep learning and growing and getting new skills. I can't tell you exactly what that will look like, but we'll work together to figure out what that is over the next few years, and we'll keep checking in. And trust me, you need people who are going to be okay with that, which I think is actually pretty unique.
Yeah, it is unique. I feel like, I know that was one of the benefits of being at a bigger company, is you really have kind of a better sense of like where your career growth is, and you kind of go along the different levels and have an understanding of like, you know, typical timeframes of when you can progress and things like that. So it's a lot, you're offered a lot more clarity in terms of where you can go and what your expectations are. And I do think that's a lot harder as a professional and as a team to manage at a smaller company, when rightfully so, those things are, you know, a bit more unclear, and the flexibility can be great because you can leapfrog around a little bit. And it can also be a little bit daunting if you're someone who wants to more know like, yeah, but what's like the title that just tell me my title. So I think that can be a little bit tricky to navigate.
We're thinking about teams and growing teams. How do you think about what positions to add next to your team when every new hire is actually probably a pretty big deal?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'm maybe, it seems counterintuitive. I think like coming to a smaller company, I've been a little bit more cautious about hiring quickly. Like I'm a little bit more, I'm going to wait and see if a product launches and lands, you know, before I go and do the hiring. If I'm, let's say I want to have them kind of like support new products or something like that on trust and safety, just to make sure that that's still going to be the business need in 6 months to a year, that sort of thing. Whereas I think, you know, it was a little bit more clear at a big company what the needs were. And so you can kind of develop that profile more quickly. I think at a smaller company, I just am, it's surprisingly just more cautious on making sure that the scope of the role is what people are wanting and what the company wants, you know, with the understanding that there's got to be some amount of flexibility as well. So I joke with, I think, you know, someone I brought on the team last year to handle one policy area, again, like expanded scope, and now is in doing kind of like all of our strategic response, which wasn't a position that we had before, but the role has kind of morphed into, and she's leading all of kind of the data analysis for our team. So I think things will morph over time, and I think that's great, but I think it can make it challenging when you're trying to decide if you want to hire for a particular role. And honestly, communicating that when you're hiring, that, you know, this is the role that we're looking for now, and those needs might change, because the last thing you want to do is to have bring someone in who is like very fixated on one thing. And that's our core area. And, you know, then in 6 months that we might have to shift what their focus is.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. I also am very cautious with hiring. And spending money in general. I'm just like a very frugal person, especially in business. And so I try to keep things as lean as possible while still being responsible to our user base and making sure that everything is covered. But, you know, it's good because it then means that you're operating with exactly the number of people that you need. And, yeah. you know, there's maybe more job stability in smaller companies than larger ones, which might actually be counterintuitive for some people, but I think it's true. And I often will trial things the same way that you do, where, you know, I'll have somebody work on something part-time or split their role between several different things. And then once it gets to the point where it's completely untenable and they just can't keep doing two things at once, then you split them in two and you hire somebody to backfill whichever part of the role the person in it didn't want. Which is sort of nice then, you know, if you're that person, you get to choose what you work on next or what you think you're good at or where you want your career to go. You have a little bit more flexibility there.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing that you had mentioned a little bit was how it's really hard to hire at a smaller company because the recruiting support is a little bit different. So I too have had this experience. Our recruiting team at Grindr right now is actually really great and they do give us a lot of support, but I'm still very hands-on with hiring and screening people. And I don't know about you, but whenever we have a job posted, because we're remote first, we're open to people all over the country and in Canada, we get insane amounts of applications, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds in just a couple of days. And when you're a small team and just one manager looking through them, it can get very overwhelming. Has that been the same experience for you?
I have had a super similar experience in terms of the recruiting team at Clubhouse is phenomenal. And they've grown and expanded. I think like one of the first things I was thinking about when you were asking me about recruiting was when I first joined Clubhouse maybe a year and a half ago, and the team was much smaller. And so a lot of like the sourcing was, you know, done by the hiring manager and things like that. So I'm spending a lot of time, you know, both on LinkedIn and trying to find in my network and also, you know, having hiring manager calls. And, I like broke down in tears one time to the recruiter I was working with. I was like, this is so much to manage. And things definitely got better and easier from there. But it feels like when you're in the process of hiring, like kind of another full-time job that you're doing in addition to managing your existing team. And so, yeah, that was one of the biggest kind of switches, going from a big company that has kind of like a, you know, sourcing pipeline and recruiting pipeline, you're kind of handed a set of candidates to be able to look at, taking kind of some of the hard search out of it. But it has been fun to dig deeper into that and feel like you have a little bit more control over the composition of your team by having to kind of put in that manual work up front. So I've definitely gained a lot of like value and insight from that experience, but it's time consuming for sure.
What do you look for in candidates? Like what things stand out to you as a hiring manager when you're looking through resumes and trying to make a decision?
Clubhouse is sounds similar to Grindr in that we're kind of like remote first, remote friendly. Like we do bring people in once a quarter to gather, but you know, we will hire folks across the country. And I've learned like, that's great. I feel like that's a right way to go about things. But, you know, you need people who are really independent and have like demonstrated a lot of initiative and people who have been able to find problems, identify them and go after and tackle them. I think especially in a remote environment where it's kind of can be more challenging to do those things, honestly. And so I think the people who have kind of that self-starter mindset, and when that's apparent on a resume, and who have like excellent communication skills, right? Like I think things are so easily dropped in Slack and hard to communicate a point via, you know, a quick Zoom meeting. And so people who really, really can do, you know, excellent work and then also kind of showcase that work in a, you know, fast and effective way, I think are kind of like some of the biggest things that I look for.
How do you screen for that? Do you have people do take-home exercises, or do you look at cover letters or previous work? Or
yeah, we've done a mix of both. No cover letters. Have you used cover letters before? I don't think we ever have really used them at Clubhouse, and I don't think we used
yeah
them.
This is controversial, but I love cover letters. When you are a remote first company, you're going to have video meetings and other things, but like you said, communication is so critical. It's such a big part of your role, and written communication, especially for policy and for customer facing people, that is your job. And so if you have a really great cover letter and you're able to convey why you're good, why you're interested in the role, what your background is, and it's well-written and it has some personality, it's going to stand out. I'll look at resumes where people haven't written a cover letter, but if you write a really good cover letter, it will stand out. I still remember parts of the cover letter that my very first hire ever. So 10 years ago, I was a Department of One, and I had to make my very first hire as a manager. And the reason why I picked them was their cover letter. It was so amazing. And it still stands out today. And it was somebody who didn't have any background in the actual job, but was able to really, really clearly make a case for themselves based on the letter. And so I interviewed them and it was great. And they actually, we still work together today.
It's amazing.
All this time later.
Stop advising people not to do cover letters. It sounds like it's been really helpful to you. That's cool.
I think that as a job seeker, they can be really frustrating because if you're applying to tons and tons of jobs, then taking the time to do a perfect cover letter for every single one is prohibitive. And some people just don't have that extra time. If you're trying to make ends meet and working a ton of freelance jobs,
know who looks at them? Like, Google really didn't look at cover letters. It was really all about the resume. So you don't want to spend time doing something if, you know, it's no one's going to look at it anyway.
Yeah. I one thing that I've heard a lot about, I'd love to hear your opinion on this, is so I hear from a lot of people who work in adjacent fields to trust and safety, sort of similar to you, where you had an intelligence background, but it wasn't in tech and in trust and safety. Mm-hmm. And I hear from a lot of people with intelligence backgrounds or law enforcement or social services or academia who really are interested in tech companies and working for tech companies, and their skills are obviously very, very transferable. But then if you look at their resume, it's like, well, I can see that you probably have transferable skills because, you know, they're sort of similar backgrounds, but you haven't demonstrated that in tech yet. And I think that a lot of people who I've talked to in those situations are getting very frustrated because they're not able to find jobs. They're not able to kind of break into trust and safety in the way that they hope. And so for those people, a good cover letter might make a big difference. But I think another difference, and you know, this is something that I've been asking managers, is I don't know, maybe this is different in big companies, but in smaller companies, there aren't very many mid-level roles for people who've already had a full career or a mid-career don't want to start working as like a frontline content moderator. Like, they're overqualified for those more entry-level roles, but need experience in particular areas in order to have the next level up. I don't know that in small companies those roles really exist. I'm happy to hire people with no trust and safety or tech background for the more entry level areas, but for mid-level, like, I need people who've done the job before, because they're going to have to wear so many hats.
Just yeah, like someone more senior in their career might not be excited about doing some of the stuff that you kind of have to come in and do. Yeah, that's true. I've had a similar experience. Like I found that people were able to find roles like that, you know, very senior coming from government and things like that, especially in areas like policy development, around the Intel side of the house for, you know, a Google and YouTube who has kind of like their own intelligence unit. But it you're right. It is much harder at a smaller company because you're going to be doing everything of a mix of like, you know, you might be meeting with the co-founders and trying to convince them of a new policy, but then probably the next minute you're going to be on a vendor call discussing the nuance of, you know, one piece of policy, really like sexual content policy. And you're going to kind of have to switch gears and be okay with doing a super hands-on on the ground task and something pretty strategic. So I think it can be hard to find people who are excited about that kind of mix. And also, you know, that makes sense for the company.
Do you always hire people who have been a content moderator before?
I haven't. No, I haven't. I think that's interesting. I think, I feel like we've definitely worked with content moderators and brought on folks who have done a phenomenal job, but, haven't had that be a requirement ever. Have you at Grindr done it that way?
The number of people that I've hired in trust and safety at Grindr specifically is not very high. But we all do have that background. And so I've been sort of questioning it lately and thinking about it and thinking about what are the things that I think are so critical and important from people with that background? And is that the only way to get that experience or to understand it? I think for me, it's because I think it's very important to have a close connection with the customers and to understand exactly what the impact is for our users for everything that we do. And so if you have been a frontline moderator before, you see the impact for customers all day, every day, and you really understand the ins and outs. And so when you're at a very small company, having that very, very strong operational background gives you the ability to understand what the impact is going to be, not just for the users, but also for the moderators. Frontline content moderation is always going to be the bulk of trust and safety work. And then you have the proactive piece that you kind of put on top of that. And the proactive piece is more important in many ways because that's what's preventing the issues to begin with. And the further I get in my career, the more that I work with product teams and the more that I think about what are the solutions so that, you know, in an ideal world, you would have zero frontline content moderators at all because users would never have any problems with each other and they'd all behave perfectly. And so then you wouldn't need moderators. So that's kind of how I think, but coming from that background, it makes me a little bit more sensitive to what the knock-on effects are going to be.
I haven't used that as a hiring strategy, but I do think it's important from like a team standpoint that everyone stays pretty closely connected to the content and does the core reviews and, you know, handles escalations and gets that same kind of experience that our, you know, content moderator vendor partners are doing so that you don't kind of lose that touch point and have that understanding of like, what is it actually like to do the review? What are the pain points? What are the process issues that folks are experiencing? So I think that's super important when they come on. I don't know. I'll have to think about that from a hiring standpoint, but I think we've brought in a bunch of different folks from all kinds of backgrounds and so it definitely hasn't been limited to that, but I feel like we do have kind of like a diverse team who've come from all sorts, like other tech companies, but then law enforcement, one came from a law firm, like it's all over the place. And I feel like that's made for a really fun team dynamic where it's, there has certainly not been one path, but that's true across trust and safety in general. That was true at YouTube as well. And I think one of the things I liked about the field that much where it was, there's not you go to college and, you know, get this degree. It's like people, you don't have to go to college. You don't have to get this, you know, particular skill set to land in this space. And I think that's really, really fun about it.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thank you so much for joining me and having this conversation. I hope it's useful to some people to understand a little bit more about working in small companies and hiring at small companies, at least from our perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
Every small company is going to be very, very different. I think that's one thing that is guaranteed, but maybe this gives people a little bit more insight. So thanks for chatting.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's been so fun. So I appreciate it, Alice.
Trust in Tech is a project of the Integrity Institute. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating and review and tell your friends. It really does make a difference. Trust in Tech is hosted by Alice Huntsberger, produced by Tal Habeig and Lauren Wagner, edited by Alice Huntsberger, and music by Zhao Shen.